and out of sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, it is powered by our friends at the African American Athlete.com. And what makes this show possible? The guy who makes me sound so fantastic. He is my producer and the founder of the African American Athlete.com. He is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we have a guest today. I am so excited because if you aren't inspired after listening to this interview, I don't know what can do it. So without further ado, let's go into the Coach's Corner and visit with the iconic Tyrone Muggsy Bogues. Hey, Muggs, how are you, man? A privilege to have you in the Coach's Corner.
Thanks for having me, Coach. It's an honor to be on the show.
Well, we're going to start off. I love the name Muggsy. To me, it is one of the best nicknames of all time in sport. Let's talk about the origin of the name, who gave you the name, and researching it. At first, you didn't particularly like the name.
No, I didn't particularly like the name at first. You know, growing up in the city of Baltimore and in Lafayette Projects Housing Authority, I mean, it was a challenging situation. You know, my first nickname was Apple. You know, when I was four years old, I used to have a bald, shiny hair and kept it close. And they always said my hair looked like an apple. So, you know, that was something that kind of, you know, grew on me. But then once I started really pursuing the game of basketball at the age of 5 and 6, you know, it just, a show at the time used to come on in our neighborhood. Well, not just in our neighborhood, but we used to watch it all the time on Saturday. And one of the characters' names was Muggsy. And he was kind of like the little leader of his little crew. And they kind of tied his character the way I was playing the game of basketball because I was stealing the ball a lot. They were like, he's out there mugging everybody. And then my boy Cole, but man, that's Muggsy from the Bowery Boys. And, of course, I thought they was, you know, I didn't like it because I thought they was making fun of my mug and everything. But, you know, as it kept going, as it grew, you know, it kind of, you know, it grew on me as time went on. Mm-hmm. It became part of me around the age of eight. I think I started accepting around 8 or 9.
Fantastic. Now, look, you have been a part of so many stories, folklore. So confirm or deny this. Now, I'm looking at a basketball report, date December 4th, 1990. And the report reads as the following. The day that the 5'3" Muggsy Bogues dunked, or did he? There are more than a few sources out that claim that Muggsy Bogues dunked during a pregame warm-up session. But video evidence, it is difficult to confirm.
Well, I mean, it was plenty of times that I was able to dunk a basketball. I mean, that was, you know, I had a 44-inch vertical. I just never dunked in a game. You know, I had a 44-inch vertical. You know, I can really grab a volleyball and just go dunk it easily. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basketball, you know, it was kind of because I had small hands. So I never even wanted to embarrass or try to do anything to that nature in the game. I just always felt like two is two. But, yeah, in terms of just messing around, you know, playing and practicing, and, you know, I was able to get up there and throw it in.
And you were you authored a book, Autobiography in the Land of Giants. And in the book, as you just made reference to early on about the struggles growing up in Baltimore, in the projects, talk about that, but also talk about your rock, your foundation, your mom.
Well, you know, just like any other kid, you know, faced with those type of opportunities, you know, you're going to try to make the most out of it any way you possibly can and try to, stay active any way you possibly can in the right direction. And the key was that with my mom, you know, my sister and my brothers, you know, they kind of kept me focused. But my mom was the one that really gave me the confidence to keep doing the things that I was able to do, you know, because, again, as a kid, being small and out there pursuing things that a game, especially the basketball game, that where folks felt like you need to have a certain height to play it, you know, and I did all the sports. I wrestled, ran track, played football, played baseball. Mm-hmm. I did all of that, but for some reason, you know, basketball kept drawing me to that, to the court, and, you know, and always kept hearing a lot of negative criticism. You always heard the short jokes. You know, every time you went down there, you know, the short jokes really, you know, stung out. And I recall going home telling my mom how the kids used to always talk about how short I am and I need to focus on other things and do this and that, and not even knowing what she was meaning, told me, you know, Ty, you know, because at the time, my nickname, she didn't really, never called me Muggsy. She always called me Ty. She said, Ty, don't ever let nobody be an expert in your life. You know, they don't know how big your heart is. They don't know your capability or your potential. You just keep going out there and do what you want to do. And I'm like, oh, okay, Mama, but I'm all upset. But as I got older, that always stuck with me, you know, because it really did. And it allowed me to really, you know, just take on the challenge and let the negative stuff just come in one ear out the other and just keep focused on trying to learn this game of basketball. And luckily for me, I had a good teacher in my neighborhood by the name of Leon Howard at the Recreation Center. Yeah, Mr. Howard, he put that knowledge in me and gave me that opportunity to understand the game of basketball.
We're going to talk about the Leon Howards and the Coach Wades and others in a second. But a minister once did a sermon that stuck with me. And the theme of the sermon, Muggsy, was some defeats are more triumphant than victory. And what he meant by that was sometimes we can take an extreme negative and make it a super positive. Talk about that unfortunate situation when you were just 5 years old, but you took that as a positive and it propelled you to the person that you are today.
Well, yeah, I think that really started the whole process for me, I believe, the mindset, I should say, you know, being shot at 5 years old, being in my neighborhood, you know, wasn't supposed to be outside, snuck out the house, and moms and dad didn't even know I was outside. My brothers and I was out there, and my sister, but they didn't realize what was happening. A fight took place, and after the guys broke the old man Chester's window, he ran to his shed, grabbed his double-barrel shotgun. All the kids started to run. I ran, slipped, and unfortunately, you know, a friend of mine came and picked me up, but unfortunately, we both got hit with the buckshots. The bullet kind of skipped us, but all the buckshots kind of got both of us, and he dropped me, and I fell, and next thing you know, I woke up in the hospital. But I do recall, you know, from that moment on, and every time I went to the basketball court, because once I used to go to the basketball court, and as I said, I used to tell my mom how it used to affect me. But every time since then, going to the basketball court, and when people said those things, it really had no impact. I mean, it was really no impact whatsoever. I was so much focused on, you know, trying to learn the game at that size that I was, and just trying to learn how to dribble, how to shoot over taller guys, and, you know, how to not get your shot blocked, and all that type of stuff, and all that was kind of at the forefront of my mindset more so than anything else.
Tyrone Muggsy Bogues is in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams, and you had mentioned Mr. Leon Howard, and just about in every city, every community, there's a giant of a man or woman who influences so many young boys and young girls. In your area, that person was Leon Howard. Talk about him.
Yeah, Coach Howard, Mr. Leon Howard, I mean, he did so much for so many kids growing up in the inner city, especially coming from Lafayette. And that was our safe haven. He was director of the center. He took a lot of kids under his wing. I mean, starting from Skip Wise, you know, the great Skip Wise and Eli Gibson, you know, then, you know, trickling down from the Duke Richardson, you know, and it goes from the Barry Scott, And then from the Byron Scott to the Kenny Mazzoys and then Dwayne Woods and the Kevin Bush, you know, and then it trickled out to myself and the Reggie Williams. You know, and Mr. Howard just was able to just instill in so much knowledge of us at the time, which we really so needed, you know, especially me and Reg. You know, me and Reg was like two little sponge. And he was just giving us the information. And then, you know, for me, of course, we both were learning different things, you know, because of my size. And Mr. Howard, you know, he was kind of relatively a small guard playing at, you know, when he was in college at John C. Smith. And he taught me the little trinkets in terms of how to handle the basketball low, how to keep it low, your crossover. But defensively, how to kind of keep guys in front of me, not let guys get past me, how to make it very difficult for guys to get in front of me. And understanding that, you know, that understanding of, you know, from, you know, fundamentals and all the little techniques, shooting over broomsticks, you know, and making sure that I was able to get it over a taller guy, and just telling me about, you know, the importance of a point guard, you know, running a team, you know, and then having that knowledge, you know, for so long, and then able to, you know, get under Coach Wade, you know, to showcase it all, you know, that was the ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about some of your influences on the court. You had mentioned a number of guys before you, the Skip Wise, the Larry Gibsons, people like that. But who were some of the people that you looked up to? I mean, there are tons of folks that came behind you that used you as a model. But who was Muggsy Bogues' model coming up?
Well, the guards was in front of us was Kevin Bush and Dwayne Woods, you know, Coe and Duke. You know, Coe and Duke was the two starting point guards at Dunbar, you know, and they happened to be my, you know, who was one of my best friends, Daryl Woods, happened to be, you know, Dwayne Woods' uncle, and you know, a good friend of my brother, and my brother kind of, you know, they kind of shadowed each other. And, you know, for us, you know, that was our teachers, you know, our mentors. You know, especially for Cole, for me, being small, undersized, having the ability to you know, maneuver around big guys and, you know, have so much success against big guys. And he was the one that taught me that defensive prowess in terms of how to let a guy go in front of me, act like he beat me, and come and steal the ball behind him. So, you know, I pretty much kind of picked that up from him. And he was the guy that, you know, I always kind of predicate my game. Give him credit for that part of it in terms of it allow me to elevate my game to a point to where, you know, that part of it, you know, it gave me so much ground to cover against my opponent, which made them, you know, have to think, you know, more ways than one.
Mm-hmm. And every program, every prominent program, basketball, football, et cetera, in the country, has a certain amount of pride that's handed down through the years, through the decades. DeMatha over here, Dunbar, D.C., but none greater than Poet Pride. Talk about what is Poet Pride, where just from every generation, it's like one big family, and you guys just take pride and the players who came before you and the players who are after you?
Well, because a lot of us, you know, a lot of players that go through Dunbar, you know, they're true competitors. You know, there's a lot of talent that started before they even got to Dunbar. You know, the competition that went on from project to project, you know, competing against one another, and then all of a sudden have an opportunity to come under one umbrella. And now, you know, you guys have the same common goal and able to, you know, and that's what builds the dynasty that we was able to have at Dunbar, you know, and the talent pool around Baltimore was unprecedented. And, you know, they could say there was the Mecca around is New York and other places, but, you know, we always felt that the Mecca of basketball was right there in Baltimore. You know, we had so much talent, you know, coming through the city, you know, guys, you know, due to their own decision-making, you know, weren't able to carry it as far as we was able to do it. But, you know, it was so much talent that came through that. And Dunbar, you know, that pride always, you know, stood out among anything. And that's one of the reasons why we call the poet, you know, Dunbar Poet Pride, you know. And that's one of the things that, you know, that kind of keep us, you know, separated from the others.
You know, 1982, I'm coaching private school here in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and we're in a tournament in Baltimore. And I see Cardinal Gibbons playing.
Mm.
And I look at them, and they had at the time, they had Tim Cole, Marty Johnson, Burgess, Mike Brown as a sophomore. And I'm saying, good gracious, what have I got myself into? And so after the game, I'm talking to Mike Brown, and I'm saying, man, you guys must be the best team in Baltimore. He said, no, coach, we number three. And I said, number three? He said, that's right, Calvert Hall and Dunbar. I bring that up, Muggsy, to talk about those 2 years in the early 80s, the 82 season and the 83 season. It was special in Baltimore. Talk about those two seasons, your teams, and some of the teams you had to compete against.
Yeah, there was a talk. I mean, even the year before I got there, you know, Calvin Hall and Dunbar was really the big talk of the town. And when they first met, and then Calvin Hall came on top that year, you know, that was really something that they kind of really talked about. And then when I got there, the following year, we was able to go into an amazing run. I think we won 31 in that year, went 31-0. We was able to take on a team that was considered the number one in the nation at the time, was Camden. And they had the number one player at the time with Billy Thompson. We had the number two player in the nation, which Reggie Williams, alongside with David Wingate and Gary Graham and Tim Dawson. So we were stacked. But we went up to Jersey and was able to, you know, prevail against the number one team during in 82. So we felt like, you know, we was the number one team in the nation as well as in the country. Calvin Hall right then had a remarkable year at the same time. But at that year, we didn't get a chance to face off, and I'm quite sure everybody wanted to see the Dunbar-Calvin Hall face off. But at the time, we had so many talented teams, as you mentioned, Cardinal Gibbons. You know, we played them down at the Civic Center for that Charm City game, and that was a good showing for a lot of the city. A private school and then a public school got a chance to face off, which was probably very rare. And it brought everybody out. You know, we put on the show down there. We was able to, prevail against Cardinal Gibbons. But that was, that was special times for all of us. You know, myself, Coach Wade, Reggie Williams, Keith James and the Mike Browns and the Tim Dawson and the Daryl Woods. I want to mention all of my teammates because they all deserve it.
Absolutely.
And that's how special it was. And the late Reggie Lois, may he rest in peace.
Muggsy Bogues is in the coach's corner. Tyrone Muggsy Bogues, one of a kind. And when you talk about the Camden game, and of course I respect your humility, but you just told half of it. You go to Camden. And, you know, Camden is a tough place, boy. I tell you, it is a tough place traditionally to go up and play. And, of course, they've got a great team. As you mentioned, one of the top players in the country that year, Billy Thompson. You come on the court, and the fans start laughing at you. But I tell you what, 5 minutes into the game, they stop laughing and saying, boy, that little guy could play. Talk about that experience.
Well, you know, I guess that was the first time they've seen a guy my size out there with so-called the big guys. And, you know, inquisitive minds wanted them to know, I guess. And, you know, they had a little chuckle. They were supportive of their point guard and Kevin Walls, who happened to be about 6'4", 6'5". And,
mm-hmm.
and I think he, you know, as the start of the game, he pointed down to my head like, he has an easy day, and like, you know, it was going to be very relatively easy for him. And the crowd fed off of it, started laughing. And I recall Coach looking over and asking me, was I okay? And I'm like, Coach, this ain't nothing but a part. I'm fine. And again, as the tip-off took place, he wasn't laughing too much. You know, the first time he put it down, you know, a couple times I was able to strip him. We went down there and scored on the first three possessions. We really kept the crowd solid. We had them boys by 31 at halftime, wound up winning probably about 25. But it was a special game. You know, I recall when we pulled up to the gym, the number one player, as you mentioned, Billy Thompson, he pulled up in a limousine. And we looked over like, ooh, who's that getting out the limousine? And here it is. It was Billy Thompson. We're like, oh, my goodness, this how they come to the game? And Reg, you know, Reg, the competitor he was, he couldn't wait. And was licking his chops like he couldn't wait to get the chance to play against the so-called number one player in the nation, knowing that he was the number one player in the nation at the time. So, you know, that was some fuel that put on the gasoline, allowed us to go in there and do what we was capable of doing.
Now let's talk about that team, especially your senior year, arguably one of the greatest high school teams ever assembled in the history, not just in Baltimore, but in the nation. Talk about how so many talented players came together and played as one unit in various roles.
Well, that's credit to Coach. You know, that all goes to him. You know, him able to manage all those egos and understanding the talent pool that he had and how to make it all operate as one. You know, we all followed his lead. I mean, he was Coach meant so much to all of us because he was the one that kind of preached that student athlete. You know, we all, you know, at the time, you know, that terminology was thrown around, dumb jock. And for him being a professional athlete himself and, you know, being an educated man, you know, he wanted to set the tone for us and embedded in our mindset, being a student athlete is the way to carry ourselves. And that was something that we believed in. We understood that, you know, it was something more important, just our own individual accolades, and we checked our egos at the door, even though we had some big egos on that team. Oh, my goodness,
yeah.
Even the guys that came off the bench, I mean, they was, you know, stars in their rights as well. So, but there was some great, and, you know, we always say our greatest competition always came in practice because, you know, we had some guys very talented, and everybody was fortunate enough to go into to a Division I school, but it all stems from Coach. Coach was the one that kind of was able to manifest all those egos and had that chemistry operating as one to where that talent pool, you know, became what it was.
And speaking of Coach Bob Wade in practice, your practices were known by Coach Wade's having bricks, putting tape on it, and you guys would just go through multiple drills with bricks in your hand that were taped. Talk about that and how that really helped you in the ball games, especially deep into a ball game, third or fourth quarter.
Well, that was Coach's way of getting our mind mentally tough and strong and you know, doing any type of, you know, things that relates outside of basketball, but related to basketball. You know, he used the bricks in terms of, you know, not having weights and that type of equipment in the facility to where we can continue to strengthen our hands when the fourth quarter came. Sandbags on your back and that sort of thing to strengthen your legs, make sure you can, you know, withstand, you know, when the fourth quarter comes, you can power your way through. And you know, those are the methods that he taught. And that was something that it carried on to me as when I coached in high school, because that became something, you know, really mentally focused, a mental toughness, and it allowed you to really kind of work your arms, work your hands, work your legs, you know, and do a lot of things, you know, with your hands, strengthening in terms of without the basketball. And then I felt that it really, you know, helped us, you know, along the way as well as on the court as well as off.
And speaking of coaching, you were the coach on the court. And as you mentioned earlier, you had so many stars, players who were used to being the number one player on their middle school or junior high school team. As the coach on the court, how were you able to keep everybody happy? In other words, did you say, okay, we got to feed the big guy, Reggie, but Wingate has to get a certain amount of touches, or this guy has to get a certain amount of touches. How were you able to keep everybody happy and everybody hungry?
Well, for me, I understood everybody's strength and weakness in it, but we all had one goal. It was no, you know, I'm going to give you this many shots or you get that many shots. It, you know, it was all who was open. We distributed the thing equally. Everybody can have a night. David can have his night. Reg can have his night. Tim can have his night. Gary could have had his night. You know, I could have my, you know, my thing was making sure everybody, you know, played the game. We played the game the right way. You know, you open, you shoot it. But more importantly, you know, we knew who our scores were. You know, so the ball floated and operated through, you know, through our guys in terms of once they were able to put the ball in the hoop. And we had plays, set plays to where we ran. We pretty much, you know, scored off our defense most importantly. Most importantly, you know, we was a defensive oriented. You know, we created a lot of steals, a lot of opportunities, get out and fast break. And that's where all the excitement and fun came. But when it came to half court, I mean, we had stretches. Strategically where we wanted the ball to go and who, you know, who got that shot. And we did a really good job of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You go to Wake Forest, okay. But before we get to you at Wake Forest Tobacco Road, man, I'm saying here in D.C., personal friend of John Thompson, we got Reggie Williams. We got Wingate. Why don't we have Muggsy Bogues? I know you've been asked this question 1,000 times. Why didn't you go to Georgetown? How come you didn't follow Reggie and David to G-Town?
Well, I almost went to Georgetown. And Coach Thompson, you know, he would have taken me if I would have actually wanted to go, but, you know, he was upfront and honest that he had Michael Jackson at the time. Michael was a sophomore, and, you know, they just came off, you know, big season, and bringing Reggie and already having David there, you know, it made sense for me to just go join them with Patrick, you know, being the center. But for me, it just felt like, you know, I had a different calling. And then you know, when Wake Forest came, and knocking on the door, and, you know, I had the opportunity to go down and visit and looking, you know, what they had and who was in front of me. Danny Young had 1 year left, and I felt like, you know, I have an opportunity to learn under Danny for 1 year then take on from there. You know, that's how players thought back then, you know, as opposed to the one and done. So, you know, I was thinking in terms of growth, and then that, and at the same time, knowing that the ACC was one of the toughest conferences out there.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yeah, and, you know, you had, you know, the Mark Price and the Lenny Bias and Michael Jordan, Kenny Smith down at Carolina, the Vince Hampton and them guys down at Clemson, and Johnny Dawkins and Tommy Advocate at Duke. So you had so many players. And then, and more importantly, it came on TV every Saturday. You know, my mom's, because she could cut that tube on and watch our baby play, where, you know, not have to go and travel so much. So, you know, a lot of things that kind of came into in favor. Plus, Wake was a challenge for me, you know, knowing that academically, if things didn't work out on the court, that I'll be set and have, you know, an education and a degree from a prestige college that I'll go on and continue to be successful. So a lot of things played a part, even though it was a different world, you know, from where I was coming from, but it was a challenge that I was willing to take.
At Wake Forest, you averaged 15 points a game, close to 10 assists, 3.8 rebounds. I got to ask you about that later, and 2.4 steals per game. What adjustments, what were some of the transitions that you had to make from high school to college, but not just college, to the ACC, as you just spoke of?
Well, when I first came in the ACC and came in, you know, I always was a pass first type of point guard, and we had so many scores. You know, my first year, my first two years, I'll say, with Kenny Green and Delaney Rudd and Anthony Tichy, Danny Young, and those guys. You know, we was fortunate enough to go all the way to the Elite Eight and lose to the 5 Slam Pajamas that year. But then after my second year, Coach Tacy, you know, he decided to give it up and move on. And then Kenny Green, he decided he wanted to go hardship at his junior year. and that left and Delaney Rudd was graduating. So everybody was leaving besides Mark Klein and myself. And then we got a new coach in Bob Stack, and I thank Coach Stack more than I ever have, because he was the one that told me and gave me the opportunity to really start looking for my shot more. He said that, you know, Muggs, you're the best player we have on the team, and I need you to score more. And that's all he needed to say, because I know I was capable of scoring. It was just a matter of looking for it more, having that opportunity, you know, in terms of being a scorer, then pass first, pass second type of guard my last 2 years of college. That's what really, you know, put me on that stage for being able to represent the USA team in 86, mm-hmm. where we was able to go over to in Madrid and win a gold medal. And then, of course, my senior year, being able to get drafted, you know, number 12. You know, and that all stems from their opportunity. Start looking for your shot more and being able to score more and do more things than just pass or steal a basketball.
Tyrone Muggsy Bogues is in the coach's corner, and expound on playing in the ACC in the 80s against the likes of a Michael Jordan, a Johnny Dawkins, on and on. Any MJ stories when he was at Carolina and you competed against him at Wake Forest?
Oh, no, because, you know, he was the two. I was the one. I was playing against Kenny Smith.
Okay.
So Kenny was over there in the Delaney Rudd, no more or less. And, you know, the way it always come from Coach Smith. You know, Coach Smith always told those guys, if you don't see Muggs, you know, make sure you pick the ball up, you know, because if not, the ball going to be gone. And so that was always a quote that he always had, and I always kind of remember from him from the time that from Carolina, playing against the Carolina teams. But MJ, you know, he was Michael Jordan at the time, still becoming that guy. And but it was some good, you know, Sam Perkins and James Worthy and Big Cricket and those guys were there too. Mm-hmm. So there were some battles, you know. But we had some, you know, you mentioned Len Bias. Woo, what a talent
he was.
ACC. May he rest in peace. Boy, I tell you, he was just 2 inches taller than Michael and had the same jumping ability. And, you know, who knows what the development would have happened and once he got to that next level. You know, so it has been scary to see that.
Now, you certainly at 5'3" had God-given athleticism and quickness. But talk about from a fundamental standpoint, from a preparation standpoint, what were some of the keys? What were some of the things that you looked at, the tendencies of a ball handler, to be able to strip the average ball handler on a regular basis?
You know, understood me being small. I knew the way I played defense, how I was all up in your pocket. I pick you up 94 feet. And, you know, I always, you know, was learned and taught how to count, you know, how to time your dribble. You know, not so much count your dribble, how to time your dribble. You know, once the ball starts going down to the floor, you know, you can't stop it. So, you know, and those are the things that, you know, you work on and on the timing aspect of it. So, and being small, again, you know, for me, I had to use my size to do what I knew how to be impactful. You know, couldn't play the game the same way like everybody played it. You know, I had to be disruptive, you know, on the defensive end. And on the offensive end, I had to be creative. You know, I had to be a playmaker. You had to also be able to score the basketball but keep everybody off balance to where they don't just focus on one. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I was able to play 14 years in the league. But on one leg the second half of my career. People don't understand that part.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, because as you stated, I'm aware of that, but a lot of our listeners may not be. Talk a little bit about playing injured the last part of your career.
Well, you know, all the way up until 94, you know, from 90 to 94, Muggsy and Stockton and Mookie Blaylock, you know, we was the lead, top three leading in assists. You know, we was averaging 600-700 assists a game and a year. And I was on my way, of course, averaging a double-double and 92 or 93 and starting to, you know, move up the ladder. Then, unfortunately, right in that series, just before the series of Chicago in 93-94. After we beat Boston in 92-93, coming back that next year, that 93-94, I hurt my knee in a bone bruise and bone on bone. And from that moment on, you know, I was on one leg, and then I had to adjust my game. You know, and people, and then that's when I started looking for my shot even more. I started shooting a lot more threes during my second half of my career. But at the same time, I was still able to compete on one leg and not move the way I was, you know, accustomed to moving. But at the same time, still wasn't being exploited. But still, that the knowledge that I had and the way I played the game and the respect that I was able to have, you know, I was still able to withstand and play 14 seasons. Would have been 17, had 17 season of contract, but when mom passed away in 2001, you know, those last 3 years, I just didn't have the energy to go back out, and I felt like, you know, I had enough. You know, it was time to move on to something else. But got paid for 17, so I thank Mark Cuban for that.
No question about that. What a story. As we continue our visit with Tyrone Muggsy Bogues in the Coach's Corner, and after a fantastic career, as we just discussed, at Wake Forest, as you mentioned, you drafted the 12th overall selection, first round of the 1987 draft. Now, folks, if you don't remember that, that wasn't a chopped liver draft. You had David Robinson. You had Reggie Miller. You had Scottie Pippen. You had Kevin Johnson, just to name a few. And Muggsy Bogues, our guest, was drafted in the first round with those guys. What was it like? 5'3", 35, 36 pounds, been told all your life, can't, won't, impossible. And now you're being drafted not just the first round, but the 12th overall pick in a talented draft year.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, that was the day the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders, you know, changed the narrative of my entire family. But, you know, we had a great class. You know, that was the guys that we came in. As you mentioned, the David Robinson went one, Amir Gilliam went two, may he rest in peace. You know, Dennis Hobson went three, Al Boy, Reggie Williams went four, and then we had, of course, five from Scotty, and Kevin Johnson, Kenny Smith went six, Kevin Johnson went seven. I mean, we had who went eight. You had Horace went eight, and Dirk McKee went eight, and Horace went with number 10. Then you had Reggie Miller went 11, and myself went 12. Mark Jackson went 18. Al Reggie Lewis, may he rest in peace, went to Boston, you know, in 22. And, you know, we had so many guys in that draft. Dirk McKee and Olden Polynes, Tellus Frank, Cadillac Anderson. I mean, we had so many guys that played multiple years. I mean, over 10-plus years in that draft.
You know what I like, Muggsy, is that every professional basketball player that I've ever interviewed can tell me the players who were drafted before him and right after him. That's amazing. We had Adrian Dantley on last week, and he was able to reel off the five players that were drafted in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we never forget that day. I mean, that's the day that everybody looked forward to. And, you know, the moment, again, about to change the narrative of a lot of families. And, you know, the excitement, you know, and the memories will never be erased. You know, those are something that you live for.
Now, as a fan here in Washington, certainly I was familiar with you at the high school level and at the collegiate level. And so I was excited because I felt that you would add tremendously to a bullet team at the time. But I got to tell you, Muggsy, I got a little upset because, you know, I'm an old school straight basketball guy. You know, I don't like the pageantry. And when they started talking about you being the smallest player in history at 5'3", and Manute Bol being the tallest at the time at 7'7", you know, I'm saying, come on now, this isn't about a circus or show business. This is about assembling a team that can make the playoffs.
Well, you know, and I felt like, you know, this was the opportunity, and I was so thankful that the Bullets drafted me, and I thank Donnie Furr and all that, and I never say anything negative about the Washington organization because that's where it all started
sure.
for me. But I always felt like, you know, they just gave up on me too soon. And after we lost to Detroit in the playoffs that year and having my exit meeting, they told me that, you know, we was going to kind of bring in some more youth guys that kind of get up and down a little more, you know, because we had a lot of guys at the time was on, you know, on the tail end of their career. You know, Moses was on the tail end of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Bernard King was on the tail end of his career. We had a couple young guys with John Williams at the time. Yeah, Darrell Walker was on the tail end of his career. So we had a lot of young, older guys mixed in. Jeff Malone at the time. And then when they told me they was going to bring in guys to kind of uplift the, you know, to kind of fit what you do, and I thought I fit perfect with those guys because they were shooters. I just needed a little more experience to get my feet wet. But, you know, and I went home at that a great exit meeting, and by the time I got home, the phone rang, and my agent said, you know, Muggs, look like Charlotte's going to be, you know, you're going to be headed to Charlotte. And he said that, you know, Washington decided they didn't protect you. And I said, well, I just left the meeting, and they just told me that they was going to bring in other players to kind of fit what we're trying to do here, up-tempo. Well, you know, they went a different direction, and I said, so that's how that happened, and came down to Charlotte, and you know, and that's where my career really started to blossom. But Washington, man, I love Washington playing for playing in the Cap Center. But then, of course, every time I went back to Washington, I wanted to beat them every time, and I had some. Of course, I had some amazing. We had some amazing games of playing against the Bullets and. With Wes Unseld over there coaching, and I used to give Wes a lot of smack, you know, because you know he was coaching at the time and
right.
coming back, and so that was some good times with me and Larry Alonzo, you know, and Dell, you know, having fun times in the arena. I always had to have 100 tickets when I went back.
Oh yeah, no question. And boy, you guys had a smoker, you know. You had Alonzo Mourning. And you had Grandmama, Larry Johnson, and a couple others. You guys were always deep into the playoffs. Talk about that team assembled. And it looked like it was almost like you being at Dunbar again in high school, having the pieces around you that were extremely compatible.
Yeah, and then it was you hit it on the nail. Those two guys that really – upstage the franchise, and you know, it first started with LJ getting him at number two, and then number one, and then getting Zoe right behind the next year at number two with Shaq coming in the league. And that propelled us to be on the national stage. And then that year we was able to, you know, beat Boston that first year that the franchise made the playoff. Those two guys came in with so much aggressive belief in themselves, knowing that they was capable of playing with anybody, you know, regardless of college or the NBA, that they was on the same level with all the guys. And we used to have a lot of fun playing, you know, against the Barclays and the Malones and the Shaquille O'Neals and the Patricks, because that was the competition that those guys liked to play and go up against. And having any type of success against it, it really was so rewarding. And being part of that, man, it was such a treat and such a blessing, you know, to have those type of caliber players and then a shooter like Dell Curry on the other side. I mean, I was in heaven.
And now speaking of Dell Curry, for our younger listeners, let them know who Dell Curry is.
Well, Dell Curry is the father of Stephen Curry and Seth Curry, who's now with the Mavericks. That's where it started. You know, Dell has an unbelievable run, 16-year career, six-man of the year award, sharpshooter. That's where Steph get the shot, and Seth and his brother get the shot from, and he was the best to do it. So had an opportunity to play with that young man for 11 years, you know. So we was fortunate enough and seeing those little boys grow up to become who they are today.
I tell you, I would love to see you guard Kerry because he's quick. He's quick on his feet. He has an extremely quick release, and he'll let it go off the bus. So
yeah,
that would be a tremendous matchup. You know, you in your prime versus him playing today. Oh, my goodness, man. That would be worth the price of admission by itself.
And I told him he won't be messing with that ball, though. He won't be messing around with that ball. You better go ask Jason Williams when he first came in trying to mess around with that ball. And see, all of a sudden realized it wasn't there where he thought it was going to be.
You know, Muggs, I'm a big stat guy.
Yeah.
I'm looking at your career stats, and some I can understand definitely. You know, minutes played, 19,000. Assists, 5,557. Steals, over 1,000. Understand all those stats. But here's one you have to talk about. Listen to this, folks. Blocked 39 shots in the NBA, including Patrick Ewing shot. I mean, you 5'3", Patrick is 7'1". I saw the tape, and I watched it 2 or 3 times, and I know how you did it. But share that with our listeners. You blocking a 7-footer shot and having overall 39 block shots at 5'3". How does that happen?
Well, you know, to Pat credit, he was fading away. You know, he was fading, and I happened to be at the right place at the right time. But, you know, I had a little 44-inch vertical. I could get off my feet a little bit. So, you know, Pat was, you know, he was just, again, at the right place at the right time, fading away, and I was able to get my hands on it. But that's mainly a lot of blocks, you know, how I was able to get, you know, guys not underestimating, you know, my leaping ability. And just, you know, when you jump and taking your shot, you know, you're not jumping extremely high. And, you know, you may get up about 4 or 5 inches off the floor. Here it is, you know, I'm extremely using all of my verticals to get up there. And so that's how I was able to get a couple blocks. But, you know, it's part of the game, you know.
Yeah.
You go up, you get stripped, you get blocked.
And you were an expert at going behind the guy and stealing the dribble. And nobody was safe. Nobody was immune. You would strip Michael. You would strip Magic. You would strip them all if they didn't put the ball down right or protect the ball with their bodies.
Yeah, I mean, that was an art that I had. You know, I was able to get that ball, you know, being close to that floor, you know. But at the same time, you know, I had to have, you know, again, you know, the main objective of a point guard is to get the ball across half court to get his team into his offense as quickly as possible. If you don't have any shot clock, if you do have a shot clock, you still only have 10 seconds to get the cross across half court. If you have a shot clock, now we know that, you know, 10 seconds with a 24 shot clock, now you're down to 14. If I can make that guy work as hard as he can getting that ball across half court, and then them getting in their offense at 15 and 16, you know, seconds on the clock, then, you know, I did half of my job by disrupting their offense, not letting it flow as it go, as it normally would. And then playing behind the guys, you know, I pick a guy up 94 feet. So I let him, you know, act like he beat me. If he kind of just looking straight ahead, then I'm coming to steal the ball. But if he now worried about where I am, you know, constantly got his head on the swivel, he's not focusing what's going on down court. So really, you know, he's not really advancing the basketball, getting his team into the offense or anything. He's more or less just trying to worry about where I'm at. And I'm done my job at that point at the same time. And then I'm able to get back in front of him by the time, you know, we get across half court. So, you know, I kind of play little tricks with allow me to keep myself again out there on the court.
Talk about the game today versus when you played a few years ago. Some of the things that you like about the game today and some of the things that you don't like so much.
You know, I have no quarrels or no worries or no ill feelings about the game today because I think it's evolution. You know, it's evolving mainly based on the players and the way it is, you know, where the player is today. Guys are 7 feet tall, facing the basket, bringing the ball up the court, you know, as opposed to when we was playing, guys was facing the, I mean, with their back towards the basket. The ball started inside and came out as opposed to coming up, pulling up for a tray wop, a three ball. It's a lot more, not as physical. You know, we was able to hand check. We was able to hit guys come across the lane. We was able to camp into the lane where the big guys would just stand and camp in the lane where it wasn't no defensive 3 seconds. You know, it was just a matter of being able to, you know, create opportunity where you got to make that man move, and it all depends on the skill set of the big man where guys helped or didn't help. But, you know, the excitement of the game is it is where it is today. You know, a lot of people like seeing a lot of threes goes up, you know, but, you know, and that's a lot of scoring take place. But, again, a lot of tic-tac fouls, which a lot of guys still to the day, especially a lot of older guys say, you know, the game is soft, you know, to the day, and guys don't play as, you know, now I don't want to say they don't play as hard, but they don't hit as hard and it's not as aggressive. But, again, I enjoy what I'm saying. You know, we got, again, we got a 7-footer that could dribble up and shoot a three. And we didn't have that back in our era on a consistent basis. So we had positional players, 1, 2, 3 to 5, where now we got stretch fours and guys is 5 that's out just playing the perimeter. So I'm enjoying it. Just to answer to your question, I have no ill wills about the game today.
Now, the only problem or the major problem that I have, and certainly I've coached so many years, never played at the professional level, but I gave a stat where you had over 19,000 minutes played during your career.
Mm.
And today you have guys that complain about playing back-to-backs. You know, they'll take a game off. It's nothing wrong with them. Muggsy, I have a problem with that because, first of all, you're playing basketball. You are playing basketball. You're not digging ditches. You're playing basketball. It is a tremendous privilege to play in the NBA, to play a game that you love and get paid handsomely for it. And then you have that family that buy a ticket to see Muggsy, and you're coming to town that one time a year, and you don't play, and you're not injured. I got a problem with that, Muggsy. Help me, man. Help me with that.
Oh, well, I mean, it's, again, you know, you have guys, I guess they call it taking a little rest and management their minutes today's game, and that's just the way the game is. I mean, we don't have a good – we played probably seven games. We have 2 week spans where we probably have, you know, 9 games in that 2 week span. And, of course, now it's totally different. You don't have the back-to-backs as many as they do today. And guys are, you know, called low man. But franchises, more or less the organizations now that protecting the players and the way the coaching is going on. And it kind of, you know, take away from a lot of the fans, especially when you're East Coast and you're a West Coast team and you know you only go in that city one time, and that game where the fans, you know, looking forward to see you and you no longer part of the, you know, part of that team on the floor, and they paid all that money and the superstar not out there, you know, I understand that, but then, again, it is a business as well.
Sure.
You know, so the business side of it is where the other organization protecting their property, you know, and their service in terms of, you know, what they feel that their employees, you know, need this to where we're going to have him when a crucial time comes. So, you know, it goes both ways for me.
Tyrone Muggsy Bogues is in the coach's corner, and Muggsy, we're down to the wire. Just a couple more questions left, but I got one, a text, a great question, and they were saying that you were one of the few players during that era that was able to stay in front of Isaiah Thomas. talk about that matchup. I've said that Isaiah Thomas, in my opinion, was the Michael Jordan of players 6'1" and below. He was just that great, but you were able to contain him. Talk about your head-to-head matchups with Zeke.
Yeah, Zeke was a beast, man. I used to watch Zeke when he was at Indiana, and I was in high school seeing the things he was able to do. I was like, ooh, you know, he's pretty special with that basketball. And then having an opportunity to play him once I got into the league and knowing, you know, the type of studying that I normally do when I face my opponent, you know, I knew what he was, you know, capable of doing and what his tendencies are. So, you know, I just try to make it difficult as he possibly can. And he hates playing against a guy like myself because I always, again, you know, I always do some little tricks, you know, as it goes up, you know, I tap you on the knee and hit this, you know, a little tap on the knee, you no longer not focus on that shot, you focus on coming down. And he always just complained to the refs about that. But I always told him, you know, I never try to hurt Isaiah, but, you know, those are the things that we did and, you know, little tricks that I had to when I played against my opponents. But we had some great battles. I mean, some great battles against one another in terms of, you know, competing. And, you know, he gives me my respect, you know, every time we see one another, and I definitely give him his.
Mm-hmm. Now, after basketball, after your playing career, I should say, you go into what I would see predictable. Now, some guys go into coaching, and I say, well, I didn't see that one coming. But I think I could see that coming. As we talked about earlier in the interview, you were the coach on the floor for every team that you were a part of. But you make the transition to the coach on the bench. How was that?
Oh, well, you know, that was something I was always geared for. You know, as being I always felt like I was a coach on the floor, being an extension of the coach. Understood what players' tendencies are, how to manage each ego, knowing where the ball, where they like the basketball, and where they like to, and how you need to distribute it and keep everybody happy. And, you know, that just felt like, you know, as a coach, you know, you can have those same qualities. And I loved coaching the high school, you know, teaching the kids how to be student athletes, you know, giving them opportunity to really work on that fundamental skill, especially in the practice, but also their athleticism and being able to become the best player they can. And then being able to coach the women, I mean, that was a remarkable opportunity for me as well. You know, being having an opportunity to work with them, they taught me so much. They taught me how to continue to be professional and treat them professional, because that's who they are. I mean, they were so skillful, more than I ever imagined. The fundamentals aspect of the game they had down pat. We had also a lot of athletic women in there who was dunking the basketball in that league in the WNBA. So it was really a treat and an opportunity to work with the young ladies. And I learned so much. And coaching always going to be in my blood. You know, I stepped away from the game because I felt like, you know, God had another plan for me, had more things for me to do. And being able to travel around the world, you know, being an ambassador for the NBA, speaking with a lot of the kids and having an opportunity for them to see me personally as opposed to seeing me on the internet. I mean, it's huge. And so I'm just blessed and honored to, you know, be able to continue to go out there and encourage and inspire these youth that's out here.
You know, some of the coolest guys I know, and I know some cool guys. I'm from D.C. You know, we cool, but the Baltimore guys are cool as well. But you really had a chance to hang out with one of the coolest individuals. You were in the Space Jam movie. And, I mean, I'm saying it doesn't get any better than you hanging out with Bugs Bunny, man. talk
Tweety
about
Bird.
Your acting career.
No, but I mean, I'm not an actor by no means. I'm just blessed and fortunate that was able to be an opportunity to do some of these, you know, opportunities that came my way. You know, Space Jams is one of them. You know, being in Space Jam with all the guys and with Charles and Patrick, I'm glad that he's had a, you know, I just heard that he got released from the hospital, Patrick Ewing, from the COVID, and Sean Bradley and LJ and Charles, and of course with MJ. And it was just great, great times and great moments on the set, you know, fun times, you know, behind the scenes that you know, you'll never forget. I mean, it was just a great opportunity, not knowing that it was going to be such an iconic movie, a classic that everybody would be talking about and being shown to this day. So I'm just grateful and thankful that I was part of it. And we had so much fun. Tweety Bird, Bugs Bunny was a treat.
No question. But that wasn't just the end of your acting career. I mean, you were in other films, television. Talk about that, man. I mean, because so many other, as I said, films and sitcoms and, what, Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, we had a chance to do Saturday Night Live. And here it is, little kids always from the projects up there on Saturday Night Live. You know, so that was something special. You know, me and Charles had a chance to work with RuPaul, you know, the big, and as well as Stuart Smalley back then, who sent us was from Minnesota. So it was great times, man. I did SNL, also did, it all started from a TV show used to call Hang Time with Anthony Anderson. Anthony Anderson, when he first started his TV career, you know, so it started with Hang Time and then went on and did, you know, some Juana Man and Eddie. And of course, I had a great opportunity and thankful for Mr. David for Curb Your Enthusiasm. And so it crazy. And, you know, really had a great time doing that. And the guy from, you know, remember that? Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Larry David? Yeah, Larry David and Richard Lewis.
Larry David, yeah.
Yeah, Larry David. So they gave me an opportunity to be on that show. And of course, it was the perfect scene for me. You know, it was the perfect scene. So if those who haven't seen it, if they ever come across the episode, that's out. Yeah, that's a perfect scene for Muggsy.
Well, can you just give us a little hint? I mean, just give us what we call in the radio business a tease. What was the scene? You don't have to give us the whole piece. Give us a little bit. Just break us off something, Muggsy.
Well, it was kind of it was Richard Lewis basically was dating a young lady who happened to be dating an athlete, and he broke up with her, and then all of a sudden she become now dating an athlete, and he wanted to find out, well, how it is that an athlete is different from him. And then Larry Davis was curious, and of course we all happened to be in the restroom together, and Larry decided he wanted the people over at the stall to see exactly, you know, what he's working with in terms of what the athlete is working with, so he can go back and tell Richard. But then all of a sudden I catch Larry looking, peeping, and then I just go berserk, and I'm about to go hit him, and he all of a sudden he has a heart attack and start taking off all these
little
monsters.
Boy, I tell you, Larry David was something.
Yeah.
he was something. Man, look, this has been a fantastic interview. We always ask our guests before they leave to leave some words of wisdom. We call it WOW, parting shots. And I can't think of anyone with more of an inspirational story, as we've said throughout this interview, of defying the odds, people telling you at a young age, you can't, it's impossible, forget about it. But through the grace of God and the counsel of your mother, she told you, and I'm paraphrasing, hey, tune out the noise. You can be whatever you want to be. So, hey, man, I'm going to get out your way before you just pick my pocket and leave us with some words of wisdom.
Well, it all starts with that man above. I mean, him giving you an opportunity to take part of this world and have an opportunity to go and think and dream and believe that you can be whomever you want to be, you know, and that's where it starts. And then you got to have that faith and believe in within yourself, because it stems from the confidence within. You know, we can have so many guys to motivate us, but it all comes within. If we can motivate ourselves and just believe that, you know, we can be whoever we want to be, and no one has any strings or holes on our destiny, then we should strive to be the best we can be in doing so. But as we're doing it, we got to be humble, you know, in the process. You know, we got to understand that, you know, those, you know, it's always someone there before us, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, being humble, trying to, you know, reach the top. But, you know, it's trying times right now. You know, this is unprecedented times that we're dealing with right now with this pandemic crisis that we're dealing with. So hopefully everybody's been safe out there and really doing the right things and listening to their local officials. You know, washing your hands thoroughly, breathe, you know, sneezing or coughing into your arms, and keeping your social distance. You know, I know they're starting to reopen right now, but we still got to maintain, you know, that smartness, because we have loved ones. You know, people truly have loved ones that's out here dying, and that's truly dying, and people are not taking it serious as they may need to. You know, you see a lot of people still walking around without the mask. You know, and it's mind-boggling to me. It's not so much that, you know, that you believe your belief. I understand about your belief, and God believes in everything, but we understand that we got to, you know, protect not only you, but others. You know, that's what the mask is purposely for, so we can kind of get back to some sort of normalcy, to where we respect others, you know, and not be so selfish in a way where we don't realize that, you know, we may be asymptomatic and not even know it. You know, if you haven't been tested, then how do you know? So I hope everybody just being smart, you know, out there and really, you know, understand that importance. But main importantly, just be safe and continue for your, you know, your own self being. Don't let anyone tell you, you know, what you can or what you should not be in life. You know, you can be whomever you want to be. You know, keep God first. And make sure that, you know, you continue to strive and put yourself in the best situation you possibly can.
And how can we get a copy of that autobiography in the Land of Giants? Is that still available?
Probably more or less on Amazon. You know, you go on Amazon and reach out and see if some copies. I'm quite sure some copies out there.
Mm-hmm. And, Muggsy, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. And Coach Wade, if you're listening, I know he's squirming in his seat. I always ask Coach Wade the question. I think a while back I asked you the question. So I'm going to ask again. Boy, we've got a worldwide listenership tonight. So the question again is, 73 Dunbar versus 83 Dunbar and a best of five series, who wins?
We went 3-0. That's how it goes.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I know I'm going to hear from Timmy Green, my main man. He's going to call or Skip or Duke Richardson. That would be a tremendous matchup with you and Duke.
Yeah, well, you Duke know. Come on, Duke. Shaq, Duke know. Duke left hand, baby. I love
my
Duke,
man.
Too. I mean, but that was the team, Tim Green, Skip. And not only that, they won all their games on the road, too.
Yes.
Yeah, they won all their games on the road. I know that's what they're going to come back with. But we won all our games on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But y'all ain't had a little fella, though.
Yeah, that's right. And the little fella, I tell you, you were the difference maker because of not just on defense, which we focus on a lot tonight, rightfully so, but when you have a player with the ball that no one can stay in front of, and he can break any defense down, that's trouble. That is extreme trouble. Hey, Muggsy, man, I really appreciate this. Thank you so much. And I tell you, you have been an inspiration to me and so many others. Continue to inspire and teach and motivate. And God bless you and your family, man.
God bless you and yours as well, Butch. Appreciate you, buddy. Stay safe.
All right, folks, and that was the iconic Tyrone Muggsy Bogues, the smallest player ever to play in the NBA at 5'3". But that was just his physical dimensions. If you measure his heart, boy, he's the Lion King. And I really want to thank everyone for tuning in. In the Coach's Corner, up next will be Gerard Mustaf from DeMatha High School, of course, the University of Maryland, and the NBA. So coming up this Thursday at noon, you will hear Gerard Mustaf. And as always, I want to thank our sponsors. I want to thank Horton's Funeral Services. They are located 600 Kennedy Street Northwest. You can give them a call at 202-829-9000, again, 202-829-9000, and ask for Randolph Horton, my main man, Reds Bowman. Also, If you're in need of any dental care, don't hesitate. Call 202-667-8818, 202-667-8818, and ask for Dr. Edward T. Buford. They're located 1209 U Street, Northwest. Well, folks, thanks for tuning in. I look forward to seeing and hearing from you on Thursday, as we said, in the locker room, in the coach's corner on In and Out of Sports will be Gerard Mustaf. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. My main man, Rick Hampton Sr., great job as always. Take me home.
You'll listen to a 30-second demo.